This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice to the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, where that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org, wamf.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on those websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Alex Cobham, who is the CEO of the Tax Justice Network and has written a new book called The Uncounted. Welcome to Wade's World, Alex.
Thanks a lot, Wade. It's great to be with you.
Well, and, you know, we always wonder, even in this modern world of communications, if we're going to successfully connect England to New Orleans to Little Rock and make it work, and somehow this is going to happen. Tell us why you decided to write Uncounted, Alex, and a little bit about your work.
Well, I'm an economist, and, you know, mainly originally working on international development issues. And you spend a lot of time looking for data, thinking, I could answer this question if I just had some better numbers. And then you find the numbers that exist, and you answer the question with those numbers. It turns out this is a pretty bad way to operate, and you consistently get the wrong answers, and you ask the wrong questions because you're constrained by the data that's there. I think nowadays that we are, you know, the generation of big data, of open data, of transparency and all of that. And actually, I argue that we're the generation of the uncounted. So much of our data is characterized by missing people and missing money. So many groups of marginalized people, marginalized in one way or another, are missing from our data. We don't count them in censuses, in household surveys. We don't let them vote often. We don't include them for public services because the data are just bad and bad in systematic ways. And then at the top end, rich people, increasingly, and major corporations are able to go uncounted in terms of paying their taxes, meeting the social obligations that the rest of us pay. So we end up with much higher inequalities than we realise, and inequalities that are not even counted in our data for us to do something about it. So we kind of bounce along thinking it's just about okay, without realising that the data that are telling us that are hiding the very things that we should be caring about.
And one thing that's a through line throughout your book, The Uncounted, is what's missing is a political decision, isn't it, Alex?
That's right. And I think, you know, perhaps naively, I always imagined it's really, you know, just a technical question with data.
We get all about the numbers.
Right. You know, and we'll get the numbers right. And then, you know, then the policymakers will make the right decisions. And, you know,
exactly. What a wonderful world.
Yeah. It turns out the more you look at this, and once you've got this idea in your head, you find it everywhere in every data set. It turns out that the people who are missing for not technical reasons, but political reasons. They're missing if it's something that you'd like to be counted for, like having a vote or getting public services. People are missing because they're politically excluded, you know, because they're from a minority group, because they're living with a disability, because for some reason or another, they just don't have as big a political voice in that particular country. And people who are missing from things that you don't necessarily want to be counted for in the same way, like having to pay your taxes, well, they're missing because they've got the power to go missing. They've got the power to make sure that they're uncounted. And so these questions at both ends are political. It's the political failure to confront inequality is mapped out once again in our data. And that means we don't even understand the inequalities that we're tolerating. and living it.
And you found this consistently true over your career in terms of low-income families, poor people, women, some other groups. I think disabled was a good example. There were just things people seemed to not want to deal with, so they just didn't ask the question.
That's right. And it's, you know, different things play into this. You know, I'm British, obviously, and, you know, we carry the responsibility for one of the biggest and probably the nastiest empires in terms of world history. One of the things that empire did was to go around the world kind of dividing people up into ethno-linguistic groups, and then basically counting some of them and not others in terms of you know, who would be able to have a vote if anyone was allowed to have a vote. Certainly, who would count in terms of function of any resources for public services and so on. The chapter on censuses in the book is probably my favourite chapter title, and that's actually about your piece of the empire. It's we the people, but only some of them. And, you know, from the very beginning, the US itself made an explicit decision that not everyone would be counted the same. And, you know, although in formal terms of voting that's now been unwound, actually in practical terms, if you look at who's counted and who's systematically undercounted in the US census, which you might expect to be kind of the biggest and best census in the world, actually it's still pretty much the same pattern. You know, if you are black, if you are Hispanic, the chances of being uncounted are just much higher than if you are white. Equally, if you're lower income, if you're from migrant populations, you're much less likely to be counted. So you're much less likely to have a vote. And so your local government is much less likely to receive funding to provide you with public services. And of course, yeah, a good government would be saying, what's the thing that we can do to make sure as far as possible that everyone is counted? But unfortunately, you don't have a good government. You have the other sort. The Trump administration has really done everything possible to try and worsen the inequalities in who is counted in the census. And unfortunately, I think you'll be, you know, living with that for the next 10 years.
Well, obviously, it affects reapportionment in terms of how many seats the states have in Congress. It affects distribution of federal funds that are based on these formulas. And that's part of what makes the census chapter was obviously one of the ones that was particularly timely now in the United States, because, I mean, we've had, as you recognize in your book, the whole controversy about, for a while, there was a question where they were trying to ask people about their citizenship status in the actual census, which is guaranteed to have people worried about citizenship not reply to the census, and led to a huge undercount of particularly Latinx voters and citizens here, or not citizens, but people who would have been counted. But this is fairly common in censuses from what your book argued.
That's right. And you know, again, I go back to the history of empire. The problem is greatest when the government is not widely considered to be legitimate. You know, if you trust your government and think that it's basically looking out for your best interests, then you don't really have a lot of concerns about telling it who you are. But if you're from a group that has been consistently treated badly by government, then you're much more wary. And so it's as much that leads you to be, you know, one thing that you can do is perhaps exert your power to go uncounted, so the government doesn't necessarily know who you are. And that, you know, has in history has applied to people, you know, groups from homosexuals, for example, trans people, but also people from different ethnic minorities, or people with disabilities who, under many regimes, not only Nazi Germany, for example, were often treated to terrible treatment in terms of experimentation or ideas based on eugenics and so on. So people have chosen where they can, sometimes deliberately, to go uncounted. But that in turn exacerbates the problems when governments are actually looking to do something more positive, providing public health and education, for example, and the same people are missing. And so their inequality is deepened by this. And yeah, the citizenship question that the Trump administration has introduced after, and this is important, after seeing the evidence that it would systematically reduce the participation of certain groups that are systematically less likely to vote Republican, is probably the biggest, you know, given that we're talking about something like $880 billion worth of public spending that's contingent upon the census. This is probably the biggest single case of deliberate uncounting by a government in these modern times, and indeed perhaps ever. It's, you know, it's happening almost without you know, more than a few eyebrows being raised. It's, I suppose, so far down the list of bad things that this administration has done in terms of the day-to-day, but actually will affect everything in US politics and society for the next 10 years if it isn't really challenged today by people going out and saying, I demand to be counted, and I will exert that power at least to make sure I'm included in my family in this census.
And of course, we have the problem now, the pandemic, which has, even if there had been a good, well-prepared census effort, well-funded, which it wasn't, the fact that so much of the count requires some door-to-door activity, that's only just beginning with the census due only months away. We're talking to Alex Karam, who's a CEO of the Tax Justice Network, and also we're talking about his book, The Uncounted, which is recently out. Tell us about the Tax Justice Network. That seems to be something that's been quite effective in this area.
Sure. So it's, you know, the privilege of my life to be able to lead this organization. But this was set up by my predecessor, John Christensen, who had been the chief economic advisor to the island of Jersey, which is a British crown dependency, and one of many British tax havens. And you know, John really had a Damascene moment. I think he'd always understood the risks, and he came to the position that he would establish the Tax Justice Network to lead the fight globally against tax havens. And the damage that they do, both in terms of stripping the revenues away from countries where real activity takes place by allowing undeclared assets of individuals and the profit shifting of multinationals, but also the undermining of financial regulation and of standards of governance, you know, promoting an enormous amount of corruption by muddying the waters about who owns what and who's paying what and who's paying who. You know, all of that, John had this conception that without a sustained effort to join up the different academics and practitioners, campaigners and activists around the world, that we would all continue losing against these same issues. And so that's, you know, what the network does now, really, is pushing ahead on things. And I guess, you know, we were established in 2003, back when I was happily just an academic at Oxford University, sitting quietly and thinking I'd just do some little bit of research.
And, so much,
you know,
for that.
you get dragged into these things, and suddenly you're an advocate. You know, we put out then a kind of policy platform, which at the time was written off by you know, governments and by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, and by the International Monetary Fund. You know, since anyone in this space just said this is completely unrealistic, even if we agreed more or less with where you want to get to, it's never going to happen. It's utopian. And you know, for a long time, it kind of felt like that, and we were tilting at windmills and trying to work with media, with a lot of training of journalists and activists, building up confidence to talk about what are quite technical issues.
Absolutely.
And, you know, 10 years down the road in 2013, the G20 group of countries told the OECD pretty much to pursue our agenda. And, you know, so what they call the ABC of transparency. So A is for automatic exchange of information between jurisdictions. So if you have a bank account in Switzerland, if you're a tax resident in the UK, then Switzerland should tell the UK that. So it's much harder for you to just pretend it's not there and not pay tax. B is for beneficial ownership and transparency. That means when you make a choice like your company, which changes your liabilities, and you know, then you're going to interact with other businesses and compete with them and perhaps provide to consumers, that people should know who you are. You shouldn't be able to hide that information in the British Virgin Islands or Cayman, or indeed Delaware. That should be on public record, so everyone knows who they're dealing with. Really, no market ever worked better when people didn't know who they were dealing with, and a lot of bad things happen when you're allowed to behave anonymously. And then C is for country-by-country reporting. And that's a measure we introduced, or proposed, I should say, for multinational companies to declare where they employ people, where they make their sales, where they declare their profits, and where they pay taxes in each country they operate in. So they can't just hide all that information in one global set of accounts, which might say, you know, most of our activity is actually in the US and India and Germany, but all of our profits have ended up in the Netherlands and Luxembourg. And so getting that information in the public domain as a way of holding multinationals and tax havens accountable has been key. And these three things, you know, we're not there yet with all of them, but we have a lot of that information now. A lot of countries moving in the right direction on those things, including the OECD itself. So, you know, there's a lot of money still out there uncounted, but we've got the policy tools in place. You know, and all beginning with a few random academics and people around the world who could just see the unfairness of this and recognised, I think, to go back to an earlier point, you know, that although these are very technical questions, if you don't have people in the room who are driven by social justice, then the political decisions will stop you making any progress. And that, I think, if the Tax Justice Network has done anything, it's to make these decisions political, to force them into the open. And so we make progress bit by bit.
And some of the examples are so stark. I mean, your point that you made at one point about the percentage of GDP in Ireland that was basically make accounting for tech companies, in my language. But explain, one of the things I thought was fascinating is the sort of campaign that y'all are involved with, and you explicate this in your book pretty well, between illicit and illegal tax avoidance. I mean, it sounds like we're talking about angels on the head of a pin or devils on the head of a pin, but this turns out to be extremely important, isn't it?
Right, and this is, you know, one of those areas where the lobbying presents itself as very technical, but it's completely political. So in 2015, United Nations, all 190-something governments of the world, agreed for the first time that they would have a target to reduce illicit financial flows. Illicit financial flows are basically the shifting of profits illicitly in a hidden way by multinational companies to reduce their tax liabilities, the hiding of assets and income streams offshore, proceeds of corruption, of criminal markets like the trafficking of drugs and the trafficking of humans, and then some other kind of abuses of power and theft of state assets. That's, you know, very widely understood. But as soon as this target was agreed, suddenly the multinational companies and their advisors in the big four accounting firms and some major governments, including my own, began a pushback saying, oh well, illicit financial flows, profit shifting by multinational companies is not illegal, and illicit, well, that's basically illegal, isn't it? So profit shifting, that's not part of this discussion, that's not what we're talking about here, and that can't be discussed in the United Nations in case they do something about it. And so we've been having this fight really for 5 years now to try to hold on to the fact that, you know, illicit doesn't mean illegal. You know, you go to the dictionary and illegal is defined as forbidden by law. Very straightforward. Illicit is defined as forbidden by law, rules, or custom. Effectively, it's what's socially forbidden. And of course, it's precisely because the profit shifting of multinational is socially forbidden whether or not it's technically legal, and often it turns out to be when we have full transparency. But of course the multinational companies don't want to be on the wrong side of this, and they don't see themselves as equivalent to kleptocrats in a faraway country. But in a sense, that's exactly what they are. Their activities use the same channels. They shift money opaquely into tax havens where they can use or hide the proceeds. And they undermine the revenues available to states to provide basic public services to their citizens. And they promote corruption by suggesting there's one law for some and one law for another. So this framing, however unpleasant it may be for multinational companies and the Big Four, is really important because it shows and lays bare, I think, the politics of that process. We haven't yet got real action at the United Nations because of that pushback, but it's underway, and bit by bit we're getting this drive for progress. There's now a high-level UN panel that's going to come out in January with a set of recommendations for how the world can move on, and I'm confident it will include a great deal of the transparency agenda that I've just laid out, and a demand for annual accountability of rich countries and poor countries and multinationals alike about their contribution to what is being counted and to whether taxes are being paid in the places that they should be, which is what all of us as humans need.
Well, and there's obviously been, I mean, there's a controversy here where there's been some small progress trying to force some of the big companies to repatriate their profits back in the U.S. I'm sure that's true for other countries as well. And even the efforts in the EU to start taxing the big tech companies differently because they're such poster children for this illegal flash, illicit, you know, button, who's got the button when it comes to their profits and employee numbers. So there's progress, it seems.
There is. And, you know, just yesterday, the OECD finally published some aggregate data based on the country-by-country reporting standard that they introduced, which, of course, was based on our original proposal. Now, that data is flawed in a number of ways, but it really is the biggest single step forward that there has ever been for our ability to see these gorillas in the mist, these enormous global companies that wander around the planet very often not paying their taxes.
Right.
Just with that data from yesterday, we've been able to show that roughly $1.3 trillion a year of the profits of multinational companies is shifted away from the countries where the profits actually arise and into tax havens instead. Pretty much every country around the world, whether it's a major economy like the United States or some of the poorest countries in the world, from you know, the likes of Malawi or Nepal, and then countries in between, South Africa and Germany, pretty much every country is losing in significant quantities from the revenue losses due to that behavior. And when we look around the world, you know, today you mentioned we're doing a census in the pandemic. You know, I think people are feeling more than ever just how important the ability of their governments to respond effectively to crises is, and in particular, the importance of public health services that are effective and well-funded. The money that we're all losing, you know, from this profit shifting, is what's being stripped away from our health services, from our governments. Our governments have less money and they spend it less well because we're not able to challenge effectively these losses. You know, imagine we have, let's say, $500 billion a year of lost revenues just to profit shifting. That's another $200 billion due to assets being held offshore and not declared at home. That money would go a very, very long way in terms of additional nurses, in terms of providing protective personal equipment for those nurses, and in terms of running health systems that can actually deal with the scale of the crisis we're facing. And we've been losing that money every year, year after year, without really putting up much of a fight. I think, you know, the tide is really turning now. It's been coming slowly, but the public anger about these issues feels to me different now. I think we're starting to get, if you like, a demand for these things to be counted, at the very least.
Exactly, and the way the NHS has been underfunded in recent years, that goes without saying. We're coming to the end of our time, but I've got to ask you about two things that were sort of favorite notes I'd made. One is the fact that the FDI is such a specious figure in so many countries. I forget exactly the example now, but I think the level of FDI that countries were claiming in some country, you said, was larger than their entire GDP.
It's extraordinary.
Those figures are all fakery, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, so the size of the distortions in FDI, which often is just a company like Apple, for example, making a decision on paper only about where its intellectual property will be recorded, say, is now of a scale that it completely distorts our GDP numbers, gross domestic product, the most basic economic statistic that we have. The example in the book is that Ireland's GDP in 2015 jumped by 26% simply because of one multinational company's accounting decision. There was no investment, there was no economic activity, there was just a change in a set of accounts, and suddenly Ireland's GDP becomes completely meaningless. And of course the other side of that is the amount of genuine, real tax being lost in all of the countries from where profits are shifted into Ireland.
Well, and the reclassification as a low-income country to a middle-income country that has, both, it's a double-edged sword. And this is totally into data geek world, but I also love the part about the problems with Gini coefficients, which without an advanced mathematical degree, every time you read Pikeny or anybody else, you think, oh my God, what are they really saying? But I loved your argument about how we needed to have a better measure that more realistically described how poverty works.
Right, and this is one of those things, you know, economists and statisticians have known for the 100-something years since Corrado-Gini created the Gini coefficient that it's not very good, and in particular it's not very good at capturing inequality in the tails at the top and the bottom of the distribution, which is probably, you know, where we care about inequality most.
Exactly.
And it's also not very good when inequality gets very high, which again you'd think is when we care about it most. So, you know, we proposed this alternative measure, the Palmer ratio, named after Gabriel Palmer, a Chilean economist, who noticed that most of the movement in inequality is about what's happening in the top 10% and the bottom 40%. So to a fair extent, you can ignore the bit in the middle because they've got about half of the income in total most of the time in most countries, and just take the ratio of what the top 10% of households have against what the bottom 40%. And that very quickly tells you just what you need to know. How extreme is inequality in this country and which direction is it moving? And the numbers are very clear. You know, nobody knows what a Gini of 0.45 is compared to a Gini of 0.6.
Exactly.
If the top 10% of households have twice the income that the bottom 40% have, well, that's one thing. And if they have five times the income, wow, that's quite another.
Exactly.
That's just, you know, exactly. An
intuitive measure. You know, for listeners, write down Palmer ratios because that may help you someday. We've been talking to Alex Gallum about his book, The Uncounted. Alex, how do people get a copy of your book and find more about what we're talking about?
Well, I think traditionally at this point in an interview, Wade, people say, go to Amazon, you can find it there. Of course, although the reviews on Amazon are actually really nice, so please go and read them, the business model of Amazon isn't really consistent with what I'd like people to do, so please go to your local bookshop. They need you, especially now during the pandemic, and ask them to order the book for you. It's available from publisher John Wiley, or you can find it online. It's in an ebook from Wiley, wiley.com, and Uncounted, and there it will be.
And Alex, if people want to follow up and find out more about the Tax Justice Network and continue the conversation, we want to give a website there or some kind of contact information.
Sure, yeah, we're at taxjustice.net or taxjusticenet on Twitter for all your tax justice needs.
All your tax justice needs. Thank you so much, Alex. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wage World is underwritten by the Dell Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas, and as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Ransky for Wage World. Thank you.